What you're about to hear was aired on Planet Philadelphia, environmental radio show on Germantown Community Radio, 92.9 FM, WGGTLP in Philadelphia, and on gtownradio.com. Hi, this is Kay Wood, host of Planet Philadelphia. I'll be speaking today with R. Merriman Goldring. She's with a group called Philly Thrive. And R, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Happy to be here.
Philly Thrive has been very active, and there's a number of things we can talk about. But before we get into that, could you please tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I can tell you a little bit about myself and a little bit about Philly Thrive. So I've been organizing with Thrive for the last nearly 6 years. Grew up in Virginia, but have landed in Philly, and this is my home and my forever home. And super blessed to get to, move alongside my friends and comrades here and fighting for a better city for all of us. So Philly Thrive started in 2015. And the first campaign that we ran was focused actually on stopping a proposed expansion of the former refinery down at Southport. That was a successful campaign. And over the next several years, we just steadily kept building our base, building our political power, which meant that in 2019, when the refinery exploded, we were really poised to, fight for permanent closure of the refinery and to fossil fuel production in residents' backyards. Our current work is contesting for justice in the site's redevelopment. Now, this is a 1,300-acre redevelopment, nearly 2% of the city of Philadelphia, and the biggest land project in our city's history. So that has a lot of different pieces, right? From, flood plans and land use plans, making sure that warehousing and diesel trucks aren't polluting our neighborhoods, to making sure that residents have good family-sustaining jobs and community investment, and making sure that the land is thoroughly cleaned up before any of this happens.
I'd like to go into the history a bit more, because I'm not sure everyone is aware of the sorts of effects the refinery had on the citizens, which I think is the inspiration for the start of Philly Thrive.
Absolutely. Yeah, our first campaign was aptly named the Right to Breathe campaign. And that's really the shared experience that brought folks together, was the devastating rates of illness in the neighborhood. So we know that refineries cause a whole slew of health problems, from cancer to COPD and lung disease to heart disease to incredibly high rates of childhood asthma in South and Southwest Philly. And folks had been having that lived experience for decades, for generations, but nobody had really put the pieces together and connected that super clearly to the refinery as the cause, but also as the solution, right? The cause, the problem was the refinery's pollution. And the answer was to shut the refinery down to stop that pollution so that folks were no longer getting sick. Since the beginning, we've been a multiracial, cross-class movement of folks from across the city, but have always been led by Black folks who are at the front lines of environmental racism here in South Philly, and who are also at the front lines of what real solutions look like, right? Folks who are most impacted know the whole array of fake solutions are, and can spot for those, and also have just an enormous amount of clarity and vision about what Philly neighborhoods need.
I wanted to get into what you're doing now and some of what you plan to do going forward. And I believe part of what you're dealing with now is the redevelopment of the old refinery site by Hilco. So could you talk about that?
Yeah. So in 2020, Hilco, which is a global real estate corporation built worth billions of dollars, purchased the former refinery land for $225 million. That purchase was actually a testament to residents organizing. They did not have the highest bid. It was actually the concerted effort that residents put in to demand fossil fuel free land use on that site that resulted in Hilco securing this site. So we're holding that clarity still 4 years later that they really owe resident organizing a lot of gratitude for their successful procurement of the site. Now Hilco specializes in sites like this, in heavily polluted industrial sites, and taking and repurposing them and turning them into something different. Hilco also has a long track record of not doing diligent community engagement and actually posing a lot of health risks to residents as they've been in the demolition, deconstruction of these facilities. We've seen this happen in Baltimore. We've seen this happen in Chicago. A demolition that Hilco was responsible for in Chicago, actually very early into the COVID-19 pandemic, released plumes of smoke and respiratory irritants. And residents just got a historic, more than $10 million settlement in response to that. So, yeah, we've been tracking, Hilco's record across the country. Hilco's current land use plan, well, we don't actually know. Let me just be candid about that. Hilco has still not shared a master plan for the site with residents, or it turns out with our city planning office, which is somewhere between absurd and obscene as we're talking about a redevelopment of this historic scale. But from the pieces of information that we've been offered, we know that their current plan centers on two main types of land use. So the first big chunk of the land is proposed to be warehousing. They're talking about 750 of the 1,300 acres being used for an absolutely massive warehousing facility. This warehousing facility will be serviced by 2,400 loading docks. I don't know about you, but I think I've only ever seen 10 or 20 loading docks in one place. So 2,400 just gives a sense of the absolutely huge scale of this plan. And what we know about warehousing is it's serviced by diesel trucks, and diesel trucks pollute people's air, and it's particularly bad for young folks and for elderly folks and for folks who already have respiratory diseases caused by the refinery's pollution. So we have a lot of concerns, unsurprisingly, about this proposed warehousing plan. A lot of our members have also been drawing, the connection between warehousing and globalization and the global supply chain, and the impacts that just this massive shipping of freight and products around the globe actually has on greenhouse gas emissions and on our ever-warming climate. And then the second major plan that we've heard of so far for this land to be used for is what's called a life sciences campus. If you don't know what a life sciences campus is, that's okay. Neither do we, and neither does Hilco, as far as we can tell. Neither do most of the folks who are moving forward development in the city right now. It's a kind of broad catch-all phrase that's used to describe these pretty high-tech facilities where medical research is happening. So that's stuff like vaccine development and medicine development. That's stuff like gene therapy and biotech. And the Hilco development is actually one of five sites right now, a proposed life sciences development just in South and Southwest Philly. Simply put, folks in the neighborhood who were impacted by the refinery's pollution don't have the formal education that would be needed to access those jobs. So our big concern there is, yeah, the pressure that it is already putting and will continue to put on the housing market and displacing longtime Grays Ferry residents who suffered from the refinery's pollution, who fought tooth and nail to get the refinery shut down, and who now deserve, who have always deserved, to be able to stay in their homes and benefit from that victory.
From my understanding, Hilco's efforts to communicate with the community and have a community benefits agreement hasn't been satisfactory. Is that correct?
It's disappointing. I'll just be candid and say it's disappointing. They brag about being a leader in community engagement and being really focused on the neighborhoods that they're coming into, but that rhetoric has not mapped onto the reality of what residents have experienced. I think one of the most stark examples is that there's been one significant public meeting on this redevelopment in 4 years. And that was only after we pushed for it relentlessly. We also have had Hilco prior to that meeting cancel, promised public meetings, I believe 3 times, two of which were the day of the event. It's been disappointing because residents deserve to talk with, the developer face to face and hear updates in an accessible way, but also really get to share their stories, their testimony, and their clarity about what they do and don't want to see. And that one public meeting we had was a really critical opportunity where residents were pressing Hilco on absolutely key issues, like the fact that their current flood plan basically doesn't take into account surrounding neighborhoods. It's focused on preventing flooding on the 1300 acre site. And their current plan is to like cap over the majority of the contamination with cement, right? And anybody who's lived in a city knows that when you put a lot of cement or asphalt down, it means that the water flows right over it. It flows faster, and that results in more flooding downstream. And so residents have been pressing Hilco on issues like the flood plan. And the reality that their flood plan is not actually up to snuff in terms of climate projections. Their current flood plan does not accurately account for what we already know is happening and is going to be, worsening climate impacts here in Philly. And so we don't just want public engagement because it feels good, right? I think that's maybe the story that gets told sometimes is it's this like, it's something we want, but like there's no way for a redevelopment of this scale to progress in good faith and actually in ways that serve the city that it's taking place in if frontline residents aren't at the table in meaningful ways.
And I was wondering about city council and the mayor's involvement in deciding what happens or advocating for what happens.
Yeah. My sense is that our elected, and this is, I think, a collective for Reed and Philly Thrive, is that our elected officials have a lot more power over this redevelopment than they're willing to use or than they have really stepped into. And so we saw when Mayor Kenney was our mayor, right after the refinery explosion, there was a series of refinery advisory group meetings, which were these sessions facilitated by the mayor's office, the managing director's office, to gather feedback about the refinery redevelopment. Have not really seen the impacts of all of that collective work, and we haven't heard anything yet from Mayor Sherrell Parker about whether she'll be taking the mantle of environmental justice and of protecting communities from airborne toxins as she steps into this new role. But we would love to see it. I think it's also really important to call out the power that City Council has around this redevelopment, and specifically District 2 Representative Kenyatta Johnson. So, folks who are listening may or may not know this, but one of the ways that City Council in Philly operates is with this idea called councilmanic prerogative. And what that means is that council members have basically agreed that if a land use decision happens in one individual council person's district, everybody else in city council backs off. And in a lot of ways, this makes city council move a little bit more efficiently, right? It means that if there's, a block that's being redeveloped somewhere in Northeast, not everybody on the entirety of city council needs to weigh in on that, which makes some sense. The folks who represent that district know best what should be happening there. But this notion gets applied to major land use decisions, including the refinery redevelopment, where it doesn't make any sense. Because, of course, what happens with this refinery redevelopment is not only affecting District 2, it's affecting the entire city of Philadelphia. And so, right now, Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, who represents District 2, and of course is now our new city council president, has a unique power to actually force Hilco to like do community engagement and to revise their flood plan and to come up with land use plans that actually protect and serve residents. And yeah, we continue to be in conversation, continue to be exerting pressure to really, get Kenyatta Johnson to come to the table with us, because this is a historic redevelopment and it would be a shame for the city to squander this opportunity. And honestly, it both would be a blight on his record if this redevelopment continues harming, frontline residents, but it's also a huge opportunity for him politically, for city council, for Mayor Sherrill Parker to go to bat for a better project and really help steward in genuine like development that serves the neighborhoods that it's occurring in.
I believe Philly Thrive has a number of things looking to the future. I believe there's a plan for something called the People's Environmental Justice Enforcement Agency, and then also a climate resiliency hub, which is through the Biden administration's Justice 40 initiative. So could you talk about some of that, please? Maybe start with the People's Environmental Enforcement Agency.
Sweet. Yeah. So a couple weekends ago, we actually held the first meeting of this new formation called the People's Environmental Justice Enforcement Agency. And basically, it's a crew of frontline residents who are taking matters into our own hands, enforcing what real environmental justice looks like here in Philly, specifically around the refinery site. So we know all permits are made up, right? They're made up by our city and our state and our federal regulators, and they're created to provide structure, basically, and to provide a set of rules and a set of next steps, really, for the people that we're regulating, whether that's corporations that are operating refineries, whether it's, small businesses running, a coffee shop or a grocery store in our neighborhood, whatever it is. That's what permits and that's what regulations are for. And so we've really identified that in Philly, environmental justice is not being considered as an important factor in how decisions are being made in development. But we know from our campaign around the refinery, and we know from generations of movement history that people do have power and that we can actually disrupt injustice really directly where it's occurring. And that can be an important wedge to get elected officials, to get decision makers to use the power that they actually already hold to move us towards justice. So to be a little bit more concrete, last October, HILCO held a groundbreaking, which is largely a ceremonial event. And there were several of our elected officials, including, Mayor Kenney at the time, Kenyatta Johnson, Senator Anthony Hardy Williams, and others. And they were all at this groundbreaking, and there were no residents there. And HILCO is bragging about being a year ahead of schedule. But meanwhile, so many of the agreements that we need to see in place, including job guarantees for surrounding neighborhoods, including this community benefits agreement, historic reinvestment in neighborhood facilities. None of these are in place. The cleanup plan is not even finalized for this site, and they're already planning on and moving towards building on it, which makes no sense in terms of order of operations. And so, yeah, we the people are going to use the power that we have to offer violation notices to HILCO. And to our elected officials who are not moving in integrity with the principles of environmental justice. I think it's worth saying we're not just like making these rules up as we go. There are foundational principles of environmental justice that come from a 1991 People of Color Environmental Justice Summit. And that has been a foundational document really for the environmental justice movement and actually for environmental regulations, including on the federal level. For the last 3 decades. So a lot of this is about story, right? And drawing out the true story that exists. And we don't just have violations, we have corrective actions, right? So for each of these places where we're saying or drawing out HILCO's lack of compliance with environmental justice principles, we also have corrective actions, much like a city or state regulator would have. And so we're not just saying, oh, their flood plan sucks. We're saying here's 4 ways their flood plan can be improved, to take into account compound flooding, to take into account climate impacts, to take into account impacts for downstream neighborhoods, et cetera, right? And so I think it's just worth lifting up. We're actually giving HILCO a really clear playbook here of what they need to do. And once they get into compliance, we'll be good.
You're talking about permits and compliance. Have you studied what permits actually now require? I mean, are they meeting those? They may not be. I don't know.
Yeah, so what we've seen is that the city has been really rubber stamping their permit applications, as so frequently happens with major global corporations or, folks with big pockets here in Philly. We see the ways that plays out unequally, right? Where like folks, everyday people in the neighborhood will get slapped with these huge L&I violations that they have no recourse to contest most of the time, and often it's for things that aren't actually big crises. And then we see, these $3 billion global corporations getting all the boxes checked. So, yeah, we know that Hilco has gotten, for example, their stormwater permit. And I believe it was actually on their stormwater permit, they were asked whether there basically had been any community concerns and whether they'd resolved those. And it was such a glaring, I guess, fess up from Hilco, really, that they clicked not applicable on whether they'd addressed community concerns. And it's worth saying, our regulators approved that permit where Hilco said it was not applicable for them to address community concerns. And I've been talking for the last half an hour about flooding, right? Like, we know that stormwater and flooding are one and the same. So clearly, Hilco knows there are concerns about flooding.
Okay, I was just wondering whether you had any kind of legal help where they could actually say, no, you are not following the rules and take them to court or something.
No, it's a
Yeah.
great question. So we do have legal support in the form actually of the CBA lawyer. So his name is Julian Gross, and we started working with him last year. And he's really the person who helped roll out and kind of bring to the main stage this tool of community benefits agreements, right? Which are an agreement between a developer and a coalition of community organizations that set forth expectations around how the development progresses and that also substantially reinvest money into surrounding communities that are, at the front lines of a development. And so we've been working closely with him on both like the CBA development and negotiation process.
Philly Thrive is also involved with the Justice 40 initiative. Could you talk about that, please?
As folks may know, the Biden administration has, passed this legislation, and through the Inflation Reduction Act or the IRA, there's just a pretty massive amount of funding for infrastructure projects generally across the United States. And so the Justice 40 initiative is a pretty groundbreaking program, and that was really won by the longtime work of climate justice activists. And that ensures that these historic federal investments in like climate and clean energy programs are actually going towards marginalized communities. So frontline communities like ours here in Philly that have been overburdened by pollution. And so this is a first for us, is applying for like this sort of massive scaled federal funding. And so the Justice 40 Accelerator is basically technical support to help us actually have the tools and the resources that we need as a frontline organization to, hopefully advance a successful application for some of this federal funding. And we know that there are so many barriers that keep, resources and funding like this from getting into most impacted communities, whether it's technical barriers or just capacity barriers. And so it's a partnership between, nonprofit orgs like ours and folks like the Justice 40 Accelerator to really make sure that the people who are most need to be able to access these resources are able to.
So, what is the project you're trying to get funded?
There's so much that needs to be done, right? Here in Philly and around the country, in terms of climate action and climate resilience. But the core vision that we're seeking federal funding for, and that's to the tune of $10 million. This is really a really massive scaling up in terms of the resources that we would have at our disposal. And so this grant would be specifically funding the creation of a climate resilience hub here in Philadelphia. And so for folks who aren't familiar with them, climate resilience hubs or CRHs are a relatively new idea that folks have really been starting to build in cities across the country. And the idea is actually basically exactly what the name tells you. It's a climate resilience hub. So it's a hub or a place where a lot of different programs and types of support come together around the issue of climate resilience. That looks like both like material support. I think, Philly has had a couple examples in the last couple years of moments where we would really need a climate resilience hub. I'm remembering when the Delaware River water supply got polluted and our folks were scrambling to figure out how to access not just water, but information about what was and wasn't safe. Obviously, also the impacts that we've been feeling in Philly, really for the first time, of wildfire smoke are a great example where, like, having a central place to gather, there's like effective air filtration can be life-saving. We're also really dreaming into a hub where we're not just meeting people's immediate material needs, as critical as that is, but we're also advancing the kind of policy work that's needed to continue to advance, climate action on a local, state, and federal level. And so this hub would have a home for a lot of this like immediate climate emergency response work, but would also serve as a home for a green jobs training program that we've been in the process of launching and the home repairs we've already begun doing in Grays Ferry with a focus on climate preparedness and weatherization, and just the resident advocacy that Thrive has been stewarding for the last nearly a decade. This would allow us to purchase a building in Grays Ferry, which would be, yeah, just an enormous an enormous win and step forward, and also to just bluntly fund the like staffing that's needed to run programs at the scale that we're running. I think one of the strengths of the Justice 40 program is it would set us on an on-ramp to being able to access more federal funding for the long term and more state funding. Community groups like Philly Thrive have historically been excluded from funding streams like this. And we know that once we get our foot in the door, we can keep that door open to more federal funding and to more sort of large-scale institutional funding that, yeah, we need and deserve.
There are agencies already in the city, like the Office of Sustainability, the ECA. Would you be partnering with other agencies to try and reach your goals?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in particular on the home repairs aspect of this climate resilience hub, it's a climate and community resilience hub. We would be partnering with Habitat for Humanity. We've also been in close conversation with folks who've done similar work. So including folks from like the Northwest Community Land Trust and folks from the Women's Community Revitalization Project or WCRP. We've also done like housing counseling work in the past with like Urban League and Community Legal Services. So that's just one example. Like the home repair is little piece of the puzzle, several partners there. I would say also we've worked really closely with folks from Penn Praxis and the Weitzman School of Design over at UPenn and like done the kind of community visioning process that would be needed. Including some visioning around like vacant sites like the Family Dollar on Grays Ferry Ave and like existing community spaces like Stinger Square. So there's just a lot of there's a lot that we've already done that this is really building on.
Do you have some tips for other people who are trying to do this sort of work?
Folks just need to find an organization. This kind of work requires our collective brain power and our collective energy. And so often the dominant culture teaches us that like we are individuals and we need to do things alone and that nothing could be further from the truth, right? We got to tackle these crises together. And I'll just say it's such a brilliant experience to get to know people and to know the place you live through organizations like place-based diverse organizations like Philly Thrive. There's no better way to build community, but also to, yeah, to fight the good fight. And I know, yeah, we're amazing, so come join us. But also there's like struggles across the city around development, around land justice, around climate justice. So really wherever folks live, wherever folks work, there is a struggle to plug into, and there's people already doing the work, so find them and and throw down.
So, how do people get in touch or find out more?
For folks who are on social media, you can find us on Facebook or Instagram, and that's one of the best ways to hear about like upcoming events and actions. You can also check out our webpage.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
If you want to know more about Planet Philadelphia, go to planetphiladelphia.com. You could also find out more about other G-Town Radio programming by going to gtownradio.com. I hope you will consider making a small monthly donation to help Planet Philadelphia continue presenting interviews on important underreported environmental topics and exploring their complexities and intersections. Thank you so much for your support.